You see the future, I said. When are we going to see each other again? Her head was bowed. I could make out only the barest gleam of her pale cheek in the reflected beam. The arm I gripped through the sleeve of the poncho might as well have been the branch of a dead tree for all the life I felt there. She said something too softly for me to make out over the sound of the rain and the river. What? I said.
I said I don't see the future, she said. I remember parts of it.
What's the difference? Aeneas sighed and stepped closer. It was cold enough that our breaths actually mingled in the air. I felt the adrenaline rush from anxiety, fear, and anticipation.
The difference is, she said, that seeing is a form of clarity. Remembering is something else.
I shook my head. Rain dripped in my eyes. I don't understand.
Rawl, do you remember Betts Kimball's birthday party? When Jaev played the piano and Kiki got falling down drunk?
Yeah, I said, irritated at this discussion in the middle of the night, in the middle of the storm, in the middle of our departure.
When was it?
What?
When was it? She repeated.
Behind us, the Mississippi flowed out of the darkness and back into darkness with the speed of a maglev train. April, I said, early May, I don't know. The hooded figure before me nodded.
And what did Mr. Wright wear that night?
I had never had the impulse to hit or spank or scream at Aeneas, not until this minute. How should I know? Why should I remember that?
Try to.
I let out my breath and looked away at the dark hills in the black night. Shit, I don't know. His gray wool suit. Yeah, I remember him standing by the piano in it, that gray suit with the big buttons. Aeneas nodded again.
Bet's birthday was in mid-March, she said, over the patter of rain on our hoods. Mr. Wright didn't come because he had a cold.
So? I said, knowing very well what point she had just made.
So I remember bits of the future, she said again, her voice sounding close to tears. I'm afraid to trust those memories. If I say when we will see each other again, it may be like Mr. Wright's gray suit.
For a long minute I said nothing. Rain pounded like tiny fists on closed coffins. Finally, I said, yeah. Aeneas took two steps and put her arms around me. Our ponchos crinkled against each other. I could feel the tightness of her back and the new softness of her chest as we hugged clumsily. She stepped back.
Can I have the flashlight a moment?
I handed it to her. She pulled back the nylon apron in the tiny cockpit of the kayak and shined the light on the narrow strip of polished wood there beneath the fiberglass. A single red button, under its clear, protective panel, gleamed in the rain.
See that?
Yeah.
Don't touch it, whatever you do.
I admit that I barked a laugh at that. Among the things I had read in the Taliesin library were plays of the absurd like Waiting for Godot. I had the feeling that we had flown into some latitude of the absurd and surreal here.
I'm serious, said Aeneas.
Why put a button in if it's not to be touched? I said, wiping the dripping moisture out of my face. The hooded figure shook its head.
I mean, don't touch it until you absolutely have to.
How will I know when I absolutely have to, kiddo?
You'll know, she said, and gave me another hug. We better get this into the river.
I bent to kiss her forehead then. I had done this dozens of times over the past few years, wishing her well before one of her retreats, tucking her in, kissing her clammy forehead when she was sick with fever or half dead from fatigue. But as I bent to kiss her, Aeneas raised her face, and for the first time since we had met, in the midst of dust and confusion in the valley of the Time Tombs, I kissed her on the lips. I believe that I have mentioned before how Aeneas' gaze is more powerful and intimate than most people's physical touches, how her touch is like a jolt of electricity.
This kiss was beyond all that. I was 32 years old that night in Hannibal, on the west bank of the river known as the Mississippi, on the world once known as Earth, lost now somewhere in the lesser Magellanic cloud, in the dark and rain, and I had never experienced a jolt of sensation like that first kiss. I pulled back in shock. The flashlight laser had tilted up between us, and I could see the glint of her dark eyes, looking mischievous, perhaps, relieved, perhaps, as if a long wait had ended and... something else. "Goodbye, Raul," she said, and lifted her end of the kayak. My mind reeling, I placed the bow in the dark water at the bottom of the ramp and leveraged myself down and into the cockpit. A. Bettick had fashioned it for me like a well-tailored suit of clothes. I made sure not to depress the red button in my flailing around. Anea shoved, and the kayak was floating in 20 centimeters of water. She handed me the double-bladed paddle, then my backpack, and then the flashlight laser. I aimed the beam at the dark water between us. "Where's the Farcaster portal?" I said. I heard the words from a distance, as if some third party had spoken. My mind and emotions were still dealing with the kiss. I was 32 years old. This child had just turned 16. My job was to protect her and to keep her alive until we could return to Hyperion and the old poet someday. This was madness. "You'll see it," she said, "sometime after daylight." Hours away, then. This was theater of the absurd. "And what do I do after I find the ship?" I said. "Where do we meet?"
"There is a world named Tien Shan," said Anea. "It means mountains of heaven. The ship will know how to find it."
"It's in the packs," I said.
"Just barely," she said, her breath hanging in the cold air. "It was in the Hegemony Outback. The Pax has incorporated it into the Protectorate and promised to send missionaries, but it hasn't been tamed yet."
"Tien Shan," I repeated. "All right, how do I find you? Planets are big things." I could see her dark eyes in the bouncing flashlight beam. They were moist with rain, or tears, or both.
"Find a mountain called Heng Shan, the sacred mountain of the north. Near it there will be a place called Suan Kung Su," she said. "It means temple hanging in air. I should be there."
I made a rude gesture with my fist. "Great. So all I have to do is stop at a local Pax garrison and ask directions to the temple hanging in air, and you'll be hanging there waiting for me."
"There are only a few thousand mountains on Tien Shan," she said, her voice flat and unhappy. "And only a few cities. The ship can find Heng Shan and Suan Kung Su from orbit. You won't be able to land there, but you'll be able to disembark."
"Why won't I be able to land there?" I said, irritated by all of these puzzles within enigmas, within codes.
"You'll see, Raul," she said, her voice as filled with tears as her eyes had been. "Please go."
The current was trying to carry me away, but I paddled the buoyant little kayak back into place. Anea walked along the river's edge to keep pace with me. The sky seemed to be lightening a bit in the east. "Are you certain we'll see each other there?" I shouted through the thinning rain.
"I'm not certain of anything, Raul."
"Not even that we'll survive this?"
I'm not sure what I meant by this.
I'm not even sure what I meant when I said survive.
"Especially not of that," said the girl,
and I saw the old smile, full of mischief and anticipation and something like sadness, mixed with involuntary wisdom. The current was pulling me away. "How long will it take me to get to the ship?"
"I think only a few days," she called.
We were several meters apart now, and the current was pulling me out into the Mississippi. "And when I find the ship, how long to get to Tien Shan?" I called. Anea shouted back the answer, but it was lost in the lapping of waves against the hull of my little kayak. "What?" I yelled. "I couldn't hear you."
"I love you,"
called Anea, and her voice was clear and bright across the dark water. The river pulled me out into it,
I could not speak. My arms did not work when I thought to paddle against the powerful current.
Aeneia?
I aimed the flashlight toward the shore, caught a glimpse of her poncho gleaming in the light, the pale oval of her face in the shadow of the hood.
Aeneia!
She shouted something, waved. I waved back. The current was very strong for a moment. I paddled violently to avoid being pulled into an entire tree that had snagged on a sandbar, and then I was out in the central current and hurtling south. I looked back, but walls of the last buildings in Hannibal hid my dear girl from view. A minute later, I heard a hum like the drop ship's EM repulsors, but when I looked up, I saw only shadow. It could have been her circling. It could have been a low cloud in the night. The river pulled me south.
Chapter 5
Father Captain DeSoya deadheaded from Pachim System on the HHS Ragel, an Archangel-class cruiser similar to the ship he had been ordered to command, killed by the terrible vortex of the classified instantaneous drive, known to Pax Fleet now as the Gideon Drive. DeSoya was resurrected in 2 days rather than the usual 3. The resurrection chaplains taking the added risk of unsuccessful resurrection because of the urgency of the Father Captain's orders, and found himself at the Omicron 2, Epsilon 3, Pax Fleet Strategic Positioning Station, orbiting a lifeless, rocky world spinning in the darkness beyond Epsilon Eridani, in the old neighborhood, only a handful of light years from where old Earth had once existed. DeSoya was given 1 day to recover his faculties, and was then shuttled to the Omicron 2 Epsilon 3 fleet staging area, 100,000 clicks out from the military base. The midshipman piloting the WASP shuttle went out of his way to give Father Captain DeSoya a good look at his new command, and, despite himself, DeSoya was thrilled with what he saw. The HHS Raphael was obviously state-of-the-art technology, no longer derivative, as all of the previous Pax ships DeSoya had seen had been, of rediscovered hegemony designs from before the fall. The overall design seemed too lean for practical vacuum work and too complicated for atmosphere. But the overall effect was one of streamlined lethality. The hull was a composite of morphable alloys and areas of pure fixed energy, allowing rapid shape and function changes that would have been impossible a few years before. As the shuttle passed the Raphael in a long, slow, ballistic arc, DeSoya watched the exterior of the long ship go from chrome silver to a stealth matte black, essentially disappearing from view. At the same time, several of the instrument booms and living cubbies were swallowed by the smooth central hull, until only weapons blisters and containment field probes remained. Either the ship was preparing for out-system translation checks, or the officers aboard knew very well that the passing WASP carried their new commander and they were showing off a bit. DeSoya knew that both assumptions were almost certainly true. Before the cruiser blacked into oblivion, DeSoya noticed how the fusion drive spheres had been clustered like pearls around the central ship's axis, rather than concentrated in a single swelling, such as on his old torch ship, the Balthazar. He also noticed how much smaller the hexagonal Gideon drive array was on this ship than on the prototype Raphael. His last glimpse before the ship became invisible was of the lights glowing from the retracted, translucent living cubbies and the clear dome of the command deck. During combat, DeSoya knew from his reading on Pachim and the RNA instructional injections he had received at Pax Fleet headquarters, that these clear areas would morph thicker, armored epidermises, but DeSoya had always enjoyed a view and would appreciate the window into space.
"Coming up on the Uriel, sir," said the midshipman pilot.
DeSoya nodded. The HHS Uriel seemed a near clone of the new Raphael, but as the WASP shuttle decelerated closer, the father captain could pick out the extra Omega knife generators,
the added glowing conference cubbies, and the more elaborate comm antennae that made this vessel the flagship of the task force.
"Docking warning, sir," said the midshipman.
DeSoya nodded and took his seat on the number 2 acceleration couch. The matting was smooth enough that he felt no jolt whatsoever as the connection clamps closed and the ship's skin and umbilicals morphed around the shuttle. DeSoya was tempted to praise the young midshipman, but old habits of command reasserted themselves.
"Next time," he said, "try the final approach without the last-second flare. It's showing off, and the brass on a flagship frown on it."
The young pilot's face fell. DeSoya set a hand on her shoulder.
"Other than that, good job. I'd have you aboard my ship as a dropship pilot any day."
The crestfallen midshipman brightened.
"I could only wish, sir, this station duty..."
She stopped, realizing that she had gone too far.
"I know," said DeSoya, standing by the cycling lock. "I know. But for now, be glad that you're not part of this crusade."
The lock cycled open, and an honor guard whistled him aboard the HHS Uriel. The Archangel, if Father Captain DeSoya remembered correctly, that the Old Testament had described as the leader of the heavenly hosts of angels. 90 light-years away, in a star system only 3 light-years from Pachem, the original Raphael translated into real space with a violence that would have spit marrow from human bones, sliced through human cells like a hot blade through radiant gossamers, and scrambled human neurons like loose marbles on a steep hillside. Radamanth Nemis and her clone siblings did not enjoy the sensation, but neither did they cry out nor grimace.
"Where is this place?" said Nemis, watching a brown planet grow in the view screen.
Raphael was decelerating under 230 gravities. Nemis did not sit in the acceleration couch, but she did hang on to a stanchion with the casual ease of a commuter on her way to work in a crowded ground bus.
"Svoboda," said one of her 2 male siblings.
Nemis nodded. None of the 4 spoke again until the Archangel was in orbit and the dropship detached and howling through thin air.
"He'll be here?" asked Nemis.
Microfilaments ran from her temples directly into the dropship console.
"Oh, yes,"
said Nemis's twin sister. A few humans lived on Svoboda, but since the fall they had huddled in force field domes in the Twilight Zone and did not have the technology to track the Archangel or its dropship. There were no Pax bases in this system. Meanwhile, the sunward side of the rocky world boiled until lead ran like water, and on the dark side the thin atmosphere hovered on the edge of freezing. Beneath the useless planet, however, ran more than 800,000 kilometers of tunnels, each corridor a perfect 30 meters square. Svoboda was one of 9 labyrinthine worlds discovered in the early days of the Hegira and explored during the hegemony. Hyperion had been another of the 9 worlds. No human, alive or dead, knew the secret of the labyrinths or their creators. Nemes piloted the dropship through a pelting ammonia storm on the dark side, hovered an instant before an ice cliff visible only on infrared and amplification screens, and then folded the ship's wings in and guided it forward into the square opening of the labyrinth entrance. This tunnel turned once and then stretched straight on for kilometers. Deep radar showed a honeycomb of other passages beneath it. Nemes flew forward 3 clicks, turned left at the first junction of tunnels, dropped half a kilometer from the surface while traveling 5 clicks south, and then landed the ship. Here, the infrared showed only trace heat from lava vents, and the amplifier showed nothing on the view screen. Frowning at the return on the radar displays, Nemes flipped on the dropship's exterior lights. For as far as she could see down the infinitely straight corridor, the walls of the tunnel had been carved into a row of horizontal stone slabs. On each slab was a naked human body. The slabs and bodies continued on and on into darkness. Nemes glanced at the deep radar display. The lower levels were also striated with slabs and bodies.
"Outside,"
said the male sibling who had pulled Nemes from the lava on God's Grove. Nemes did not bother with the airlock. Atmosphere rushed out of the dropship with a dying roar. There was a hint of pressure in the cavern, enough that she would not have to phase shift to survive, but the air was thinner than Mars had been before it was terraformed. Nemesis's personal sensors indicated that the temperature was steady at -162°C. A human figure was outside waiting in the dropship's floodlights.
"Good evening," said Counselor Albedo.
The tall man was impeccably dressed in a gray suit tailored to Pacham tastes. He communicated directly on the 75 MHz band. Albedo's mouth did not move, but his perfect teeth were visible in a smile. Nemes and her siblings waited. She knew that there would be no further reprimands or punishment. The three sectors wanted her alive and functioning.
"The girl, Anea, has returned to Pax Space," said Albedo.
"Where?" said Nemes's female sibling. There was something like eagerness between the flat tones of her voice. Counselor Albedo opened his hands.
"The portal," began Nemes. "Tells us nothing this time," said Counselor Albedo. His smile had not wavered.
Nemes frowned at this. During all the centuries of the hegemony's world web, the three sectors of consciousness of the core had not found a way to use the void portal, that instantaneous interface that humans had known as farcasters, without leaving a record of modulated neutrinos in the fold matrix.
"There's something else," she said.
"Of course," said Albedo.
He flicked his hand as if discarding the useless segment of this conversation.
"But we can still register the connection. We feel sure that the girl is among those returning from old Earth via the old farcaster network."
"There are others?" said one of the males.
Albedo nodded.
"A few at first, more now. At least 50 activations at last count."
Nemes folded her arms.
"Do you think that something else is terminating the old Earth experiment?"
"No,"
said Albedo. He walked over to the nearest slab and looked down at the naked human body on it. It had been a young woman, no more than 17 or 18 standard years old. She had red hair. White frost lay on her pale skin and open eyes.
"No," he said again. "The sectors agree that it is just Anea's group returning."
"How do we find her?" said Nemesis's female sibling,
obviously musing aloud on the 75 MHz band.
"We can translate to every world that had a farcaster during the hegemony and interrogate the farcaster portals in person."
Albedo nodded.
"But something else can conceal the farcast destinations," he said. "But the core is almost certain that it cannot hide the fact of the matrix fold itself."
"Almost certain." Nemes noted that unusual modifier of technocore perceptions.
"We want you," began Albedo, pointing at the female sibling. "The stable sector did not give you a name, did it?"
"No," said Nemes's twin.
Limp, dark bangs fell over the pale forehead. No smile touched the thin lips. Albedo chuckled on the 75 MHz band.
"Radamanth Nemes needed a name to pass as a human crewmate on the Raphael. I think that the rest of you should be named, if just for my convenience."
He pointed at the female.
"Scylla."
Stabbing his finger at each of the males in turn, he said,
"Gyges, Briareus."
None of the three responded to their christenings, but Nemes folded her arms and said,
"Does this amuse you, Counselor?"
"Yes,"
said Albedo. Around them, the atmosphere vented from the dropship curled and broiled like a wicked fog. The male now named Briareus said,
"We'll keep this archangel for transport and begin searching all the old web worlds, beginning, I assume, with the River Tethys planets."
"Yes," said Albedo.
Scylla tapped her nails on the frozen fabric of her jumpsuit.
"Four ships, the search would go four times as fast."
"Obviously," said Albedo. "There are several reasons we have decided against that. The first being that the Pax has few of these Archangel ships free to loan."
Nemes raised an eyebrow.
"And when has the Corps asked the Pax for loans?"
since we need their money and their factories and their human resources to build the ships," said Albedo without emphasis. "The second and final reason is that we want the four of you together in case you encounter someone or something impossible for one of you to handle." Nemesis's eyebrows stayed up. She expected some reference to her failure on God's Grove, but it was Gyges who spoke. "What in the Pax could we not handle, Counselor?" Again the man in gray opened his hands. Behind him, the curling vapors of fog first obscured and then revealed the pale bodies on slabs. "The Shrike," he said. Nemes made a rude noise on the 75 megahertz band. "I beat the thing single-handedly," she said. Albedo shook his head. The maddening smile stayed fixed. "No," he said, "you did not. You used the hyperentropic device with which we supplied you to send it 5 minutes into the future. That is not the same as beating it." Briarea said, "The Shrike is no longer under the control of the UI?" Albedo opened his hands a final time. "The gods of the future no longer whisper to us, my expensive friend. They war among themselves, and the clamor of their battle echoes back through time. If our God's work is to be done in our time, we must do it ourselves." He looked at the four clone siblings. "Are we clear on instructions?"
"Find the girl," said Scylla.
"And?" said the counselor. "Kill her at once," said Gyges, "no hesitation." "And if her disciples intervene?" said Albedo, smiling more broadly now, his voice the caricature of a human schoolteacher's. "Kill them," said Briareus. "And if the Shrike appears?" he said, the smile suddenly fading.
"Destroy it," said Nemes.
Albedo nodded. "Any final questions before we go our separate ways?" Scylla said.
"How many humans are here?"
She gestured toward the slabs and bodies.
Counselor Albedo touched his chin.
"A few tens of millions on this labyrinthine world in this section of tunnels. But there are many more tunnels here," he smiled again, "and 8 more labyrinth worlds."
Nemes slowly turned her head, viewing the swirling fog and receding line of stone slabs on various levels of the spectrum. None of the bodies showed any sign of heat above the ambient temperature of the tunnel.
"And this is the Pax's work," she said.
Albedo chuckled on the 75 megahertz band.
"Of course," he said. "Why would the 3 sectors of consciousness or our future UI want to stockpile human bodies?"
He walked over to the body of the young woman and tapped her frozen breast. The air in the cavern was far too thin to carry sound, but Nemes imagined the noise of cold marble being tapped by fingernails.
"Any more questions?" said Albedo. "I have an important meeting."
Without a word on the 75 megahertz band, or any other band, the 4 siblings turned and re-entered the dropship. Gathered on the circular tactical conference center blister of the HHS Uriel were 20 Pax Fleet officers, including all of the captains and executive officers of Task Force Gideon. Among those executive officers was Commander Hogan Hoag Liebler, 36 standard years old, born again since his baptism on Renaissance Minor, the scion of the once great Liebler Freehold family, whose estate covered some 2 million hectares, and whose current debt ran to almost 5 marks per hectare. Liebler had dedicated his private life to serving the church and given his professional life to Pax Fleet. He was also a spy and a potential assassin. Liebler had looked up with interest as his new commanding officer was piped aboard the Uriel. Everyone in the task force, almost everyone in Pax Fleet, had heard of Father Captain DeSoya. The former Tortship CO had been granted a papal disk key, meaning almost unlimited authority, for some secret project 5 standard years earlier, and then had failed at his mission. No one was sure what that mission had been, but DeSoya's use of that disk key had made enemies among fleet officers across the Pax. The Father Captain's subsequent failure and disappearance had been cause for more rumor in the wardrooms and fleet staff rooms,
The most accepted theory was that DeSoya had been turned over to the Holy Office, had been quietly excommunicated, and probably executed. But now here he was, given command of one of the most treasured assets in Pax Fleet's arsenal, one of the 21 operational Archangel cruisers. Liebler was surprised at DeSoya's appearance. The father captain was short, dark-haired, with large, sad eyes more appropriate to the icon of a martyred saint than to the skipper of a battlecruiser. Introductions were made quickly by Admiral Aldecacti, the stocky Lusian in charge of both this meeting and the task force.
"Father Captain DeSoya,"
said Aldecacti, as DeSoya took his place at the gray circular table within the gray circular room.
"I believe you know some of these officers."
The Admiral was famous for her lack of tact as well as for her ferocity in battle. "Mother Captain Stone is an old friend," said DeSoya, nodding toward his former executive officer. "Captain Hearn was a member of my last task force, and I have met Captain Satie and Captain Lempriere. I have also had the privilege of working with Commanders Uchikawa and Barnes-Avney." Admiral Aldecacti grunted. "Commander Barnes-Avney is here representing the Marine and Swiss Guard presence on Task Force Gideon," she said. "Have you met your exec, Father Captain DeSoya?" The priest captain shook his head, and Aldecacti introduced Liebler. The commander was surprised at the firmness in the diminutive father captain's grip and the authority in the other man's gaze. "Eyes of a martyr or no," thought Hoag Liebler, "this man is used to command." "All right," growled Admiral Aldecacti. "Let's get started. Captain Satie will present the briefing." For the next 20 minutes, the conference blister was fogged with hollows and trajectory overlays. Comm logs and scribers filled with data and scribbled notes. Satie's soft voice was the only sound except for the rare question or request for clarification. Liebler jotted his own notes, surprised at the scope of Task Force Gideon's mission, and busy at the work of any executive officer, getting down all the salient facts and details that the captain might want to review later. Gideon was the first task force made up completely of Archangel-class cruisers. 7 of the Archangels had been tasked to this mission. Conventional Hawking-class torch ships had been dispatched months earlier to rendezvous with them at their first sally point in the outback, some 20 light-years beyond the Great Wall defensive sphere, so as to participate in a mock battle. But after that first jump, the task force of 7 ships would be operating independently. A good metaphor would be General Sherman's march through Georgia in the pre-Hegira North American Civil War in the 19th century, said Captain Satie, sending half the officers of the table tapping at their comm log disk keys to bring up that arcane bit of military history. "Previously," continued Satie, "our battles with the Ousters have either been in the Great Wall No Man's Land or on the fringes of either Pax or Ouster space. There have been very few deep penetration raids into Ouster territory." Satie paused in his briefing. "Father Captain DeSoya's Task Force Magi some 5 standard years ago was one of the deepest of those raids."
"Any comments about it, Father Captain?" said Admiral Aldecacti.
DeSoya hesitated a moment. "We burned an orbital forest ring," he said at last. "There was no resistance." Hoag Liebler thought that the father captain's voice sounded vaguely ashamed. Satie nodded as if satisfied.
"That's what we hope will be the case for this entire mission. Our intelligence suggests that the Ousters have deployed the vast bulk of their defensive forces along the sphere of the Great Wall, leaving very little in the way of armed resistance through the heart of their colonized areas beyond the Pax. For almost 3 centuries they have positioned their forces, their bases, and their home systems with the limitations of Hawking Drive technology as the primary determining factor." Tactical hollows filled the conference blister. "The grand cliché," continued Satie, "is that the Pax has had the advantage of interior lines of transport and communication, while the Ousters have had the defensive strength of concealment and distance. Penetration deep into Ouster space has been all but impossible due to the vulnerability of our supply lines and their willingness to cut and run before our superior strength, attacking later, often with devastating effect, when our task forces venture too far from the Great Wall.
Satie paused and looked at the officers around the table. Gentlemen and ladies, those days are over.
More hollows misted into solidity. The red line of Task Force Gideon's trajectory out from and back to the pack sphere, slicing between suns like a laser knife.
Our mission is to destroy every in-system ouster supply base and deep space colony we encounter, said Satie, his soft voice taking on strength. Comet farms, canned cities, boondoggles, Taurus bases, L-point clusters, orbital forest rings, birthing asteroids, bubble hives, everything.
Including civilian angels? Asked Father Captain DeSoya. Hoag Liebler blinked at his CO's question. Pax Fleet informally referred to the space-tailored DNA-altered mutants as Lucifer's Angels, usually shortened to Angels, in an irony bordering on blasphemy. But the phrase was rarely used before the high brass.
Admiral Aldecacti answered.
Especially angels, Father Captain. His Holiness Pope Urban has declared this a crusade against the inhuman travesties the ousters are breeding out there in the darkness. His Holiness has stated in his crusade encyclical that these unholy mutations are to be eliminated from God's universe. There are no civilian ousters. Do you have a problem understanding this directive, Father Captain DeSoya?
Officers around the table seemed to hold their breaths until DeSoya finally answered.
No. Admiral Aldecacti. I understand His Holiness is encyclical.
The briefing continued.
These Archangel-class cruisers will be involved, said Satie. His Holiness's ship Uriel as flagship, the Raphael, the Michael, the Gabriel, the Raguel, the Remiel, and the Sariel. In each case, the ships will use their Gideon drives to make the instantaneous jump to the next system. Will take 2 days or more to decelerate in-system, thus allowing time for crew resurrection. His Holiness has granted us dispensation to use the new 2-day resurrection cycle creches, which offer a 92% probability of resurrection. After regrouping the attack force, we will do maximum damage to all ouster forces and installations before translating to the next system. Any Pax ship damaged beyond repair will be abandoned, the crew transferred to other ships in the task force, and the cruiser destroyed. No chances will be taken with the ousters capturing Gideon Drive technology, even though it would be useless to them without the sacrament of resurrection. The mission should extend some 3 standard months. Any questions?
Father Captain DeSoya raised his hand.
I have to apologize, he said. I've been out of touch for several standard years. But I notice that this task force is made up of Archangel-class ships, named after Archangels referred to by name in the Old Testament.
Yes, Father Captain? Prompted Admiral Aldecacti. Your question?
Just this, Admiral. I seem to remember that there were only 7 Archangels referred to by name in the Bible. What about the rest of the Archangel-class ships that have come online?
There was chuckling around the long table, and DeSoya could see that he had cut the tension much as he had planned.
Smiling, Admiral Aldecacti said,
"We welcome our prodigal captain back and inform him that the Vatican theologians have searched the Book of Enoch and the rest of the pseudo-epigrapha to find these other angels which might be promoted to honorary archangel, and the Holy Office itself has authorized dispensation in Pax Fleet's use of their names. We found it appropriate that the first 7 planet-class archangels built be named after those listed in the Bible and should carry their sacred fire to the enemy."
The chuckling turned to sounds of approval and finally to soft applause among the commanders and their execs. There were no other questions. Admiral Aldecacti said,
"Oh, one other detail. If you see this ship..."
A hollow of a strange-looking starship floated above the center of the table. The thing was small by Pax Fleet standards, was streamlined as if built to enter atmosphere, and had fins near the fusion ports.
"What is it?"
said Mother Captain Stone, still smiling from the good feeling in the room. "Some ouster joke?"
"No," said Father Captain DeSoya in a soft monotone. "It's Web-era technology, a private starship, owned by an individual."
A few executive officers chuckled again. Admiral Aldecacti stopped the laughter by waving her thick hand through the hollow.
"The Father Captain is correct," rumbled the Lusian admiral. "It's an old Web-era ship, once owned by a diplomat of the hegemony."
She shook her head.
"They had the wealth to make such gestures then. Anyway, it has a Hawking drive modified by ouster technicians, may well be armed, and must be considered as dangerous."
"What do we do if we encounter it?" asked Mother Captain Stone. "Take it as a prize?"
"No," said Admiral Aldecacti. "Destroy it on sight. Slag it to vapor. Any questions?"
There were none. The officers dispersed to their ships to prepare for the initial translation. On the Wasp shuttle ride back to the Raphael, XO Hoag Liebler chatted pleasantly with his new captain about the ship's readiness and crew's high morale, all the while thinking, "I hope I don't have to kill this man."
Chapter 6. It has been my experience that immediately after certain traumatic separations, leaving one's family to go to war, for instance, or upon the death of a family member, or after parting from one's beloved with no assurances of reunion, there is a strange calmness, almost a sense of relief, as if the worst has happened and nothing else need be dreaded. So it was with the rainy, pre-dawn morning on which I left Ania on old Earth. The kayak that I paddled was small, and the Mississippi River was large. At first, in the darkness, I paddled with an intense alertness that was close to fear, adrenaline-driven, eyes straining to make out snags and sandbars and drifting flotsam on the raging current. The river was very wide there, the better part of a mile, I guessed. The old architect had used the archaic English units of length and distance, feet, yards, miles, and most of us at Taliesin had fallen into the habit of imitating him. And the banks of the river looked flooded, with dead trees showing where the waters had risen hundreds of meters from the original banks, pushing the river to high bluffs on both sides. An hour or so after I had parted from my friend, the light came up slowly, first showing the separation of gray cloud and black-gray bluff to my left, then casting a flat, cold light on the surface of the river itself. I had been right to be afraid in the dark. The river was snarled with snags and long fingers of sandbars. Large, waterlogged trees with hydra heads of roots raged past me on the center currents, smashing anything in their way with the force of giant battering rams. I selected what I hoped was the most forgiving current, paddled strongly to stay out of the way of floating debris, and tried to enjoy the sunrise. All that morning I paddled south, seeing no sign of human habitation on either bank except for a single parting glimpse of ancient, once white buildings drowned amid the dead trees and brackish waters, in what had once been the western bank and was now a swamp at the base of the bluffs there. Twice I put ashore on islands, once to relieve myself and the second time to store away the small backpack that was my only luggage. During this second stop, late in the morning with the sun warming the river and me, I sat on a log on the sandy bank and ate one of the cold meat and mustard sandwiches that Ania had made for me during the night. I had brought two water bottles, one to fit on my belt, the other to stay in my pack, and I drank with moderation, not knowing if the water of the Mississippi was fit to drink, and also not knowing when I would find a safe supply. It was afternoon when I saw the city and the arch ahead of me. Some time before, a second river had joined the Mississippi on my right, widening the channel significantly. I was sure that it must be the Missouri, and when I queried the comm log, the ship's memory confirmed my hunch. It was not long after that when I saw the arch. This Farcaster portal looked different than the ones we had transited during our trip out to Old Earth. Larger, older, duller, more rust-streaked. It may have once been high and dry on the west bank of the river, but now the metal of the arch rose out of waters hundreds of meters from shore.
skeletal remnants of drowned buildings, low skyscrapers from pre-Hegira days according to my newly informed architectural sensibilities, also rose from the sluggish waters.
"St. Louis," said the comlog bracelet when I queried the ship's AI. "Destroyed even before the tribulations, abandoned before the big mistake of 08.
"Destroyed?" I said, aiming the kayak toward the giant hoop of the arch and seeing for the first time how the west bank behind it curved around in a perfect semicircle, forming a shallow lake. Ancient trees lined the sharp arc of the shore. An impact crater, I thought, although meteor crater or bomb crater or power source meltdown or some other variety of violent event, I could not tell. "How destroyed?" I said to the comlog.
"No information," said the bracelet. "However, I do have a data entry which correlates with the arch ahead of us."
"It's a Farcaster portal, isn't it?" I said, fighting the strong current here on the west side of the main channel to aim the kayak at the east-facing arch.
"Not originally," said the soft voice on my wrist. "The size and orientation of the artifact coincide with position and dimensions of the so-called Gateway Arch, an architectural oddity built in the city of St. Louis during the time of the United States of America nation-state in the mid-20th century A.D. It was meant to symbolize Western expansion of the hegemonic Euro-descended proto-nationalist pioneers who migrated through here in their effort to displace the original pre-preserve North Am indigenes."
"The Indians," I said, panting as I paddled the bobbing kayak through the last conflicting current and got us lined up with a huge arch. There had been an hour or two of rich sunlight, but now the cold wind and gray clouds had returned. Raindrops pattered on the fiberglass of the kayak and rippled the wavetops on either side. The current now carried the kayak toward the center of the arch, and I rested the paddle a moment, making sure not to hit the mysterious red button by accident.
"So this Farcaster portal was built to honor the people who killed the Indians," I said, leaning forward on my elbows.
"The original Gateway Arch had no Farcaster function," the ship's voice said primly.
"Did it survive the disaster that
did this?" I said, pointing the paddle at the impact crater lake and its assortment of flooded buildings.
"No information," said the comlog.
"And you don't know if it's a Farcaster?" I said, panting again as I paddled hard. The arch loomed high above us now, at least 100 meters to its apex. The winterish sunlight glinted dully on its rusted sides.
"No," said the ship's memory. "There is no record of any Farcaster on Old Earth."
Of course there would be no such record. Old Earth had collapsed into the big mistake black hole, or been kidnapped by the lions and tigers and bears at least a century and a half before the Technocore had given the old hegemony Farcaster technology. But there had been a small but very functional Farcaster arch over that river, creek actually, in western Pennsylvania, where Aenea and I had cast from God's Grove 4 years earlier. And I had seen others in my travels.
"Well," I said, more to myself than to the idiot comlog AI, "if this isn't it, we'll just continue on downriver. Aenea had a reason for launching us where she did."
I was not so sure. There was no telltale Farcaster shimmer under this arch, no glimpse of sunlight or starlight beyond, just the darkening sky and the black band of forest on the shoreline beyond the lake. I leaned back and looked up at the arch, shocked to see panels missing, steel ribs showing. The kayak had already passed beneath it, and there was no transition, no sudden shift of light and gravity and alien sense. This thing was nothing more than a broken-down old architectural freak that just happened to resemble a... Everything changed. 1 second, the kayak and I were bobbing on the wind-swept Mississippi, heading into the shallow crater lake that had been the city of St. Louis, and the next instant, it was night, and the little fiberglass boat and I were sliding along a narrow canal between canyons of lighted buildings under a dark skylight half a kilometer or more above my head.
"Jesus," I whispered.
"An ancient messiah figure,"
said the comlog. Religions based on his purported teachings include Christianity, Zen Christianity, ancient and modern Catholicism, and such Protestant sects as...
Shut up, I said. Good child mode.
This command had the comlog speak only when spoken to. There were other people boating on this canal, if canal it was. Scores of rowboats and tiny sailboats and other kayaks moved upriver and down. Close by, on riverwalks and esplanades, on skyways crisscrossing above the well-lighted waters, hundreds more walked in pairs and small groups. Stocky individuals in bright garments jogged alone. I felt the gravity weigh my arms as I tried to lift the kayak paddle. At least half again Earth's was my immediate impression. And I slowly lifted my face to the view of those hundreds, thousands, of lighted windows and turrets, walkways and balconies and landing pads, of more lights as chrome-silver trains hummed softly through clear tubes above the river, as EMVs sliced through the air overhead, as levitation platforms and sky ferries carried people back and forth across this incredible canyon. And I knew. Lucis. This had to be Lucis. I had met Lucians before. Rich hunters come to Hyperion to shoot ducks or demigyres. Richer off-world gamblers slumming in the Nine Tails casinos where I had worked as a bouncer. Even a few expatriates in our home guard unit. Felons fleeing Pax Justice, most likely. They all had the high-G, low-profile look of these short, stocky, prominently muscled joggers, who chugged by on the riverwalks and esplanades like some primitive but powerful steam machines. No one seemed to be paying any attention to my kayak or me. This surprised me. From these natives' perspectives, I must have appeared from nowhere, materializing under the Farcaster portal behind me. I looked back and understood why my appearance might have gone unnoticed. The Farcaster portal was old, of course, part of the fallen hegemony and of the former River Tethys, and the arch had been built into the Hive City walls, platforms and walkways studding and overhanging the slender portal, so that the segment of canal or river directly under the arch was the only visible section of this indoor city that lay in deep shadow. Even as I glanced back, a small motorboat glided out of that shadow, caught the glow of the sodium vapor lights that overhung the river walkway, and seemed to pop into existence just as I had half a moment earlier. Bulked up as I was in sweater and jacket, tightly tucked into the nylon skirt of my little kayak cockpit, I probably looked as stocky as the Lusians I saw on either side of me. A man and woman on jet skis waved as they hissed past. I waved back. Jesus, I whispered again, more in prayer than blasphemy. This time, the comlog made no comment. I will interrupt myself here. My temptation at this point in the telling, despite the hurry-up incentive of cyanide gas hissing into the Schrodinger cat box at any moment, was to describe my interworld odyssey in great detail. It was, in truth, as close as I had come to true adventure since Aenea and I had arrived at the safety of old Earth 4 standard years earlier. In the 30-some standard hours since Aenea had peremptorily announced my imminent departure by Farcaster, I had naturally assumed that the voyage would be similar to our former trip, from Renaissance Vector to Old Earth. Our voyage had been through empty or abandoned landscapes, via worlds such as Hebron, New Mecca, God's Grove, and unnamed worlds such as the jungle planet on which we had left the consul's ship in hiding. On one of the few planets where we had encountered inhabitants, ironically on Mare Infinitus, the sparsely settled ocean world, the contact had been catastrophic for everyone involved. I had blown up most of their floating platform. They had captured me, stabbed me, shot me, and almost drowned me. In the process, I had lost some of the most valuable things we had taken on the trip, including the ancient hawking mat that had been handed down since the days of the Ciri and Merin legend, and the equally ancient 45-caliber handgun that I had wanted to believe once belonged to Aenea's mother, Braun Lamia.
But for the majority of our voyage, the River Tethys had carried Aenea, Abetic, and me through empty landscapes, ominously empty on Hebron and New Mecca, as if some terror had carried away the populations, and we had been left alone. Not here. Lucis was alive and seething. For the first time, I understood why these planetary honeycombs were called hives. Traveling together through unpopulated regions, the girl, the android, and I had been left to our own devices. Now, alone and essentially unarmed in my little kayak, I found myself waving to Pax police and born-again Lusian priests who strolled by. The canal was no more than 30 meters wide here, concrete and plastic lined, with no tributaries or hiding places. There were shadows under the bridges and overpasses, just as under the Farcaster portal upriver. But river traffic moved through these shadowy places in a constant flow, no place to hide. For the first time I considered the insanity of Farcaster travel. My clothes would be out of place, drawing immediate attention as soon as I stepped out of the kayak. My body type was wrong. My Hyperion-bred dialect would be strange. I had no money, no identity chip, no EMV license or credit cards, no Pax Parish papers or place of residence. Stopping the kayak for a minute by a riverside bar, the smell of grilled steak or similar fare wafting out on fans and making me salivate with hunger, the yeast tang hinting of brewery vats and cold beer on the same breeze, I realized that I would almost certainly be arrested 2 minutes after going into such a place. People traveled between worlds in the Pax. Millionaires mostly, business people and adventurers willing to spend months in cryogenic sleep and years of time debt traveling by mercantilist transport between the stars, smug in their cruciform certainty that job and home and family would be waiting in their steady-state Christian universe when they returned. But it was rare, and no one traveled between worlds without money and Pax permission. 2 minutes after I sauntered into this cafe or bar or restaurant or whatever it was, someone would probably call the local police or the Pax military. Their first search would show me crossless, a heathen in a born-again Christian universe, licking my lips, my stomach growling, arms weary from fatigue and the extra gravity there, eyes tearing from lack of sleep and deep frustration. I paddled away from the riverside cafe and continued downriver, hoping that the next Farcaster would be nearer rather than far. And here I resist the temptation to tell of all the marvelous sights and sounds, the strange people glimpsed and close encounters chanced. I had never been on a world as settled, as crowded, as interior as Lucis, and I could have easily spent a month exploring the bustling hive I glimpsed from the concrete-channeled river. After 6 hours traveling downstream in the canal on Lucis, I paddled under the welcomed arch and emerged on Froida, a bustling, heavily populated world that I knew little about and could not even have identified if it had not been for the comlog's navigational files. Here I finally slept, the kayak hidden in a 5-meter-high sewer pipe, me curled up under tendrils of industrial fiber plastic caught in a wire fence. I slept a full standard day and night around on Froida, but there the days were 39 standard hours long, and it was only evening of the day I arrived when I found the next arch, less than 5 clicks downriver, and translated again. From sunny Froida, populated by Pax citizens in elaborate harlequin fabrics and bright capes, the river took me to Nevermore, with its brooding villages carved into rock and its stone castles perched on canyon sides under perpetually gloomy skies. At night on Nevermore, comets streaked the heavens and crowd-like flying creatures, more giant bats than birds, flapped leathery wings low above the river and blotted out the comet's glow with their black bodies. I was hailed by commercial rafters there and hailed them back, all the while paddling away toward a stretch of white water that almost flipped my kayak and certainly taxed all of my fledgling kayaker's skills. Sirens were hooting from the gimlet-eyed castles on Nevermore when I paddled furiously under the next Farcaster portal,
and found myself sweltering in the desert sunshine of a busy little world the comlog told me was called Vitis Grey Balianus B. I had never heard of it, not even in the old hegemony-era atlases that Grandam had kept in her travel caravan, and which I had crept in to study by glow wand whenever I could. The river Tethys had taken Aenea, Abetic, and me through desert planets on the way out to old Earth. But these had been the oddly empty worlds of Hebron and New Mecca, their deserts devoid of life, their cities abandoned. But here on Vitis Grey Balianus B, adobe-style houses huddled by the river's edge, and every click or so I would encounter a levee or lock where most of the water was being siphoned off for irrigation to the green fields that followed the river's course. Luckily, the river served as the main street and central highway here, and I had emerged from the ancient Farcaster Arch's shadow in the lee of a massive barge. So I continued paddling blandly on in the midst of bustling river traffic. Skiffs, rafts, barges, tugs, electronic powerboats, houseboats, and even the occasional EM levitation barge moving 3 or 4 meters above the river's surface. The gravity was light here, probably less than 2/3 of old Earth's or Hyperion's, and at times I thought that my paddle strokes were going to lift the kayak and me right out of the water. But if the gravity was light, the light, the sunlight, was as heavy on me as a giant, sweaty palm. Within half an hour of paddling, I had depleted the last of my second water bottle, and knew that I would have to set in to find a drink. One would think on a world of lesser gravity that the denizens would be beam poles, the vertical antithesis of the Lusian barrel shape. But most of the men, women, and children I saw in the busy lanes and towpaths along the river were almost as short and stocky as Lusians. Their clothing was as bright as the harlequin motley on the residence of Froida, but here each person wore a single brilliant hue, tight bodysuits of head-to-toe crimson, cloaks and capes of intense cerulean, gowns and suits of eye-piercing emerald with elaborate emerald hats and scarves, flowing trains of yellow chiffon and bright amber turbans. I realized that the doors and shutters of the adobe homes, shops, and inns were also painted in these distinctive colors, and wondered what the significance might be. Caste? Political preference? Social or economic status? Some sort of kinship signal? Whatever it was, I would not blend in when I went ashore to find a drink, dressed as I was, all in dull khaki and weathered cotton. But it was either put ashore or die of thirst. Just past one of the many self-serve locks, I paddled to a pier, tied my bobbing kayak in place as a heavy barge exited the lock behind me, and walked toward a circular wooden adobe structure that I hoped was an artesian well. I had seen several of the women in saffron robes carrying what may have been water jugs from the thing, so I felt fairly safe in my guess as to function. What I had no confidence in was the odds that I could draw water there myself without violating some law, coda, caste rule, religious commandment, or local custom. I had seen no visible pack's presence on the towpath or lanes, neither the black of priest nor the red and black of the standardized Pax police uniform. But that meant little. There were very few worlds, even in the outback, where the comlog informed me that Vitis Grey Balianus B lay, where the Pax did not have some definitive presence. I had covertly slipped the scabbard with my hunting knife from pack to back pocket.